if someone were to say to me, why did you stay in academics? We get to do something that no one else has done, number one. Number two, we get to hang out with a lot of really interesting, quirky people, right? I think number three, there's the greatest sense of success is watching a young scientist come up through the system and succeed on their own.
That's Dr. Sean Colgan, today on Behind the Microscope. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Bijan Sadi, and this is Behind the Microscope, a podcast about the people and process behind the scenes of science and medicine. We are very grateful for the opportunity to present this series, which is sponsored by the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, also known as FASEB. FASEB represents more than 110,000 researchers in the life sciences and is a federation of scientific societies that advances health and well-being by promoting research and education in the life sciences through collaborative advocacy and service to its societies and their members. To learn more about FASEB, go to www.faseb.org. That's www.faseb.org. When I started this podcast, the person that I had in mind is my next guest, Dr. Sean Colgan. Dr. Colgan has been my mentor for over a decade and is uniquely responsible for any success I have had in my academic or scientific career. What is equally impressive is that I am but one among many, many mentees that Dr. Colgan has shepherded through graduate school, postdocs, and on to rewarding careers in science and medicine. Dr. Colgan is a distinguished professor of medicine and immunology at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. He earned his bachelor's, master's, and PhD degrees from my alma mater, Colorado State University. He then completed a postdoc at Brigham and Women's under the mentorship of one of our former guests, Dr. Jim Madera. He then spent 12 years on faculty at Harvard Medical School before being recruited to the University of Colorado in 2006. His accolades and accomplishments are too many to list here, but a synopsis is provided in the show notes. Today, Dr. Colgan shares his scientific philosophy and his optimistic outlook on the future of biomedical research. Without further ado, it is a true honor to introduce Dr. Sean Colgan. And I remembered having lots of conversations with you about, like, your PhD, your postdoc, Jim Madera, Chuck Parkos, like, there were... In a way, it was a sort of like a magical history that I felt like I sort of it was part of my mythology of what research and science is, and some part of me was kind of sad that like that was just mine. Like, I know those stories, and
a few people know those stories, but they never get archived, right? They don't get told, right? And we all have those stories. It's what's beautiful about this area.
Yeah. But what's sad is that when we all die and those stories are, they're oral histories, the only thing we write down is the science.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's interesting that like we do these neutrophil transmigration assays, but like, what went into that? Not only what went into like getting that done, but like what about all of the personalities and people and the interpersonal conflict and the, you know, like I think it's not just interesting, but it's important because I think scientists have a reputation of being dry. And so that's sort of
you
why
know what I look back on this, Bijan. I look back on it and I say to myself, historically, it's those eureka moments that you look for, right? There are times that there's a lot of creativity that goes into this, but mm-hmm. you know the saying, it's 95% perspiration and 5% inspiration.
Yeah.
But it's those eureka moments when you see something happen that's happened at, you know, at the hands of a lot of people's ideas, a lot of people's hard work. And those neutrophil transmigration assays that, you know, that really it was Jim and Chuck. Mm-hmm. And there was also some other people that came through Jim's lab that contributed significantly to that. But it was a really creative time. Mm-hmm. And there was so much we could do with this mm-hmm. As a model system.
Yeah. Right?
And I think it's taught us so much about mucosal biology mm-hmm. that's now been applied to many other areas.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I think these stories just don't get told and they don't get archived. As you start to get some gray hair in this business, you start to realize that your science gets forgotten for the most part.
Yeah.
But your legacy becomes the people that you've trained.
Yeah. Right?
And those are the people that carry on your reputation, they carry on the word, and they are the ones that I think ultimately reflect on how effective and how successful your career was.
Yeah.
It's the people that you've trained.
Yeah.
There's no question.
Yeah. I mean, I heard the same sentiment from yeah. Jim Madera and from a ton of people that I've interviewed.
Yeah.
I guess we can start with this question, which is, we don't necessarily learn how to build that legacy. I think we are taught in grad school how to build the scientific legacy.
Yes.
And scientific, I mean like actual data.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come to that appreciation?
Yeah. You know, I still give this advice to young scientists today. You know, I think it for me, I realized at a young age that science and the level of science that you were doing is a really personal thing. And you know, I had two really spectacular PhD mentors. I worked in two labs. Mm-hmm. I worked in a microbiology lab and a pathology lab mm-hmm. at a veterinary school. And so I loved both of my mentors, and they were really very different people.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved them both. They just individually taught me so much. And I realized that the personal side of science was really an important thing.
Hmm.
So when it came time to do a postdoc for me, you know, I applied pretty broadly, and ultimately I selected Jim Madera's lab because I liked him most as a person.
Hmm.
And you know, I think some of the other labs were doing equivalently good work, but I especially liked him as a person.
Hmm.
And you realize, I think certainly in retrospect, you realize that, you know, your PhD and your training is a stressful time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to go through something as stressful as an education, you should do it with someone that you like.
Right.
And someone who's going to support you.
Right. Yeah.
So I think I have tried to appreciate that in each and every one of my trainees.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to instill in them the importance of coming to me with their questions and their concerns, finding and carving out time each week to catch up with them, to mm-hmm. find out where they're at in their life,
mm-hmm.
To appreciate where they're happy and where they're sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you do that, you really generate a happy environment for mm-hmm. people to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it brings the level of conflict down within the lab. I think it raises the camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
And it does a lot of things, I think, that are really important for the management of a lab.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because I'm sure, you know, and I've listened to some of your podcasts. This is one of the things that I think so many people don't realize is that, you know, each lab is a small business.
Right.
And you don't learn how to manage a lab going to grad school. Right?
No, exactly. I mean, that was one of the things we started asking people about are like, what are the soft skills? And like, mm-hmm. not even that they're soft skills. Some of it's like budgeting, but like, you know, in grad school, maybe if you're lucky, you'll learn to write a specific aims page, mm-hmm. but not like a 90 page, even F grant, right? Yeah. All of the stuff that goes into it, let alone the conflict management that you are now the head of a, so where did you learn those skills from?
Oh, I think from my mother. Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. I think a big part of it is one word, and that's empathy, right? Hmm. You have empathy for your trainees. Hmm. I don't think there's any question that that's what makes the most effective mentor and probably the best leader, right?
Hmm. Yeah.
And you also realize that I've realized this over the years is if people like to come to work and they like to come to the lab, they're productive.
Yeah.
Right. And you get you say, well, it takes a lot of time.
Right.
Right. And it does take a lot of time. If you want to get to know your employees, you want to get to know your students and your postdocs and the whole spectrum of people, it does take a lot of time. But it is time. It is selfish time for me because mm-hmm. if they're happy, they're going to do well in the lab, mm-hmm. and that makes me happy, mm-hmm. and that promotes a successful scientific career. Mm-hmm. But it does take time, mm-hmm. for sure.
And I think that's sort of a unique perspective because I think a lot of people come at it
from not a business thinking. as a business as opposed to as a personal tribute to. To the individual people.
Yeah. Right, right. And is that something unique about academics that, yes, it's a small business, mm-hmm. but like you said before, ostensibly our output is scientific knowledge, mm-hmm. but in reality, your output should be people,
yeah.
right? But those are different. I mean, people can get great research and drive their people really hard and burn out 80% of their postdocs.
Yep.
So at some point you have to make that decision. Yep. Did you always see that? I mean, I think Jim Madera's got to be a good example of that, but there are a lot of examples in science the maybe a majority of the opposite mentality.
Yeah. And where it's research, where it's results driven rather than person driven. Yes,
right.
I agree with that. But I think I still think Bijan, if you dig deep, the successful labs tend to have an empathetic approach to the people that are in the lab. Mm-hmm. There are clearly examples of where that's not the case, but you will still see that. You know, we're at this meeting here, mm-hmm. and if I look around me and see. Maybe this is a unique environment, but if I look at the mucosal biology field as a whole, it is a really well-represented group of individuals that care about their people, mm-hmm. And they care about their people very deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive, actually, to watch this and to watch the young people that have come up through the system and they very much reflect their training environment, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, they absolutely. Really
do. Yeah.
Right. All right. So then that is philosophically great, but let's say on a granular level, people listen to this podcast that are junior faculty, you know, they're finishing fellowship or they're postdoc and they're starting a lab. What advice do you have for them to build a lab culture mm-hmm. that's like centered around empathy
mm-hmm.
In an academic world that's like pretty competitive and driven by our ability to get grants, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How did you approach it? Mm-hmm. And what advice do you have for people coming who find themselves as this newly minted leader of their lab?
Yeah. You know, I would give, on a regular basis, I give two pieces of advice. I think, first of all, it's important that you recognize what your strengths are and what your vulnerabilities are. But your strengths are where your leadership skills will shine. And I think knowing what your skills and strengths are is important enough that you should sit down on a pretty regular basis and write out your mission statement. And I encourage my trainees to do that, mm-hmm. because what comes through in that mission statement is your personality, mm-hmm. and I think if you can maximize your strengths and minimize your weaknesses as a leader, that's where I think it really becomes successful. The second piece of advice I often give, and I think it's particularly true at the point of junior faculty transitioning postdoc to assistant professor, is find someone that you want to emulate, right? In other words, say to yourself, and it doesn't have to be one of your mentors. It could be someone that you see give a talk at a meeting or even read a paper and realize that's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. And introduce yourself to that person if you don't know them and get to know them. And ask specific questions on how they came to be. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important. I have probably 3 or 4 people in my life that I've tried to emulate. Mm-hmm. Jim Madera is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very calming to know that they have successfully transitioned that. And I once got advice, right, that you need 3 people in your life, and I've told you this before.
Yeah. Right?
You need 3 people in your life that you can call at midnight and they're going to pick up the phone, mm-hmm. right? And it's important to have that. And one of those people should be someone that you really try to emulate. Mm-hmm. It's swimming those tough waters and having somebody by your side in case you go under, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
That's what's important to me. So I really encourage the young faculty to do that. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, the third piece of advice that's important is find colleagues that are struggling with the same things you are, right? Because I think if you can just articulate the problem, there's always a solution, right? But it's a matter of articulating the problem. Mm-hmm. I find so many kids today, I call them kids, but, you know, I find so many of the young scientists are so fearful of the numbers that they hear, that the NIH is 15% success rates, right? And from the outside, if you ask a businessman, you know, 15% of the time things are going to be successful and 85% not, they would say, why are you doing what you're doing?
Right.
But it's not that simple.
Yeah.
And we know it's not that simple. We know that number is probably not correct in estimating what your success rates are going to be. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many things that go in, so many parts of that formula, mm-hmm. I think, that number one, you don't have control of.
Right.
Number two, these are things that you can work through.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you can find that success, but you've got to find that corner of the world that's going to allow you to do that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that sort of leads into another question, which is finding that part of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be anything from institution to environment of mentors that might be at different places. But how do you go about approaching that? Mm-hmm. Because I think that's a hard thing for a lot of us, and was a hard thing for me. And I know I reached out to you when I was trying to figure out where I should do residency and fellowship, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. like maybe land. What are some important factors that go into that? Because mm-hmm. just like having good mentors, having a good environment can be absolutely everything.
Absolutely. You know, it was interesting. I got into this, you know, at the time, it almost seemed like a crazy idea. And that was the field of hypoxia research, right? And, you know, we keep we keep bringing Jim's name, Jim Madera's name up, but it really was a conversation I had with him. And so for me, it was, I was kind of thrown in the deep end pretty fast. I had done 4 years of postdoc, and then Jim was leaving and going to Emory to become a chair. Mm-hmm. And I committed to not going to Emory. I committed to staying in Boston. Mm-hmm. And identified a faculty position, but I didn't really know what I was going to work on, right? And so the field of hypoxia was just burgeoning at the time. And I had kind of kept up with a lot of the literature around the topic of ischemia reperfusion, right? Because neutrophils play a very important part of the damage that results from ischemia reperfusion. So I remember sitting down with Jim, and he was really kind of headed out the door. And I said to him, what do you think about hypoxia in the gut? And I remember he said to me, yeah, I don't know. He said, let me sleep on that. And he came back to me the next day and said, I think that's a winner. I really think it's a winner. And that was like 1994, 1995, HIF was cloned, right?
Yeah, crazy.
Hypoxia-inducible factor. So for those who don't know that, in 2019, that was the Nobel Prize. Right. So I got in very early on the HIF field. And, you know, some of it's luck. Don't kid yourself. Some of it's luck. And I feel like I got lucky in that. But luck comes to the prepared mind, right? So I was well positioned to be in that and to be in that role. And you know, that became our corner of the world for a while. Right? We were really, no one else was working in that field. Certainly on epithelial cells and hypoxia, and certainly trying to understand what are the metabolic features that mold that tissue environment. So we got, in that regard, we got lucky. But then, you know, I think fortunately for us, we kind of owned that area for a while, and it gave us some latitude to do some things that we probably wouldn't have done. So that, in that regard, I was very fortunate. We were publishing well, grants were coming, and trainees wanted to come to the lab. So, you know, one thing fed the other, and, you know, it became sort of a raging fire for a while.
That's awesome. But, and like also maybe wouldn't have happened if you'd gone to Emory.
Possibly, right? Yes.
I mean, maybe you would have just kept doing stuff that Dr. Madera was doing. And I want to ask you about that, because you were a postdoc for 4 years. That was your first postdoc?
Correct. My first and only postdoc.
First and only postdoc. Then your mentor leaves. And you take a faculty position. You know, you get a faculty position at Brigham, right? I mean, part of the Harvard system. What was that like? Because I had this discussion the other day about being afraid of taking those faculty positions. Like, you know, like taking extra time to do more research, to like make sure that you're ready before you start your tenure clock. And it's a kind of a tough argument for people that do MD PhD and then do residency and fellowship, because we've done, you know, you end up doing like 14 years of training. And at some point, I think we have to jump in. And you did, right? You jumped into the deep end with, you know, after one postdoc at a big competitive institution. How was that? And do you, what advice do you have? Like, should we be less afraid of taking those leaps, or should we be more afraid of taking those leaps?
So I think I was terrified. I will tell you, I still remember laying in bed at night. Because I, you know, the truth is, I will freely admit I was not ready. I was not ready for that. But then I remember thinking, well, are you ever really ready? And, you know, I was surrounded by people who were supportive to me. And I remember Jim Madera said to me, what's the worst thing that can happen? You come back and be a postdoc in my lab again.
Right.
And that was, there was something very calming about that. Mm-hmm. There was something very, there was just something very comforting in a way that I, it's almost hard to put in words. And it, yeah, it was scary. It was kind of terrifying to think, am I ready to do this? But you know what? If you don't try, opportunities don't come that often, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that was a fantastic opportunity for me, and they don't come very often. Mm-hmm. And I would not necessarily consider myself, Bichon, to be a very risky, risk-taking person, huh. right? I wouldn't say that I take a lot of risk, but that was one time in my life in which I did. Mm-hmm. And, I'm so happy I did it. And, mm-hmm. you know, I became, I feel like I molded myself into a very effective mentor. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that, you know, I started recruiting postdocs and they weren't much younger than me.
Right. right?
And so we were kind of building this thing together.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I had some very loyal people in the lab who protected me, mm-hmm. like I protected them. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we built it together. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something I did on my own for yeah. sure. And it was definitely a team effort. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was terrified.
Yeah.
I wasn't ready. And I would encourage anyone out there that feels that way to take the chance. And those opportunities don't come very often. Mm.
That's great advice.
Yeah, I think so.
Because I think we're all afraid of failing.
Yeah.
Even though it's like part of the job description, but it feels like a bigger thing when you get what your dream mm-hmm. is, right? To be a faculty member and to mm-hmm. run your own lab. Mm-hmm. It feels like if you take that opportunity and you don't succeed, yeah. that is like irrecoverable.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all are a product of our upbringings, right? Mm-hmm. And I was an athlete. And I would say, looking back on that, that's one of the things that athletics taught me is you're afraid to fail, but don't be afraid to succeed, right? That's a really important part of this. And I think we, of course, we're all afraid to fail and none of us want to fail, but the truth is that you shouldn't be afraid to succeed either.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
It's something I think I probably learned that in athletics. Hmm.
Yeah.
You hear coaches say it. You hear professional coaches and college coaches say this a lot is don't go out there not to lose, but mm-hmm. go out there to win.
Right. You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes we are risk averse yeah. to our own detriment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I have two legacy questions then.
Sure.
Let's start with Dr. Madeira's lab, mm-hmm. since, you know, in a lot of ways, sort of my scientific grandfather, kind mm-hmm. of, and it feels that way, mm-hmm. like that there are so many people mm-hmm. that I know scientifically really well that have come from his lab. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's not a meeting I go to where there's not someone who spent formative scientific years in his lab, mm-hmm. you know. How did that happen?
I can tell you historically, you can count them on one hand, the number of people who have trained as good a people as he did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Jim was I think he is a great example of someone who was an MD, not an MD, PhD. Mm-hmm. who was exquisitely creative mm-hmm. and he was a deep thinking individual. But he was also a doer. He got things done mm-hmm. and, he was in the right place at the right time, but he spent a lot of time with us. Mm-hmm. He showed a personal interest in our lives. I was telling someone this story the other night. This is a good example. My first major talk when I was in the lab as a postdoc, it was the worst talk it was terrible because I was deep down kind of a bashful person. Mm-hmm. And he said to me after my talk, it was a Friday afternoon, and he said, be at my house tomorrow morning. And he put me through the ringer for several hours mm-hmm. at his house mm-hmm. in his living room. And when I walked out of there, I could give a scientific talk. Mm. And I wasn't afraid to do it. He taught me a lot of things. And that's just an example of someone showing a real true personal interest in your life. Mm. And it's, you can call it altruism. But again, it's probably not an altruistic thing that he wanted his people to reflect well on him.
Yeah.
So he invested the time because it reflected really well on his lab. Mm-hmm. And I saw him do this with everyone. Mm-hmm. And you know, success builds success. You've mm-hmm. heard that, right? And I think around when we would go to meetings, our lab became a very attractive place for smart young people to come.
Yeah.
I was Jim's first PhD postdoc, actually. He had never had a PhD in the lab. And then after that, he had a cadre of very successful people come through.
Right.
But prior to me, prior to me, they were all MDs, primarily pathology fellows. Hmm. But, you know, success builds success. Mm-hmm. And he does have, I think, one of the outstanding legacies that I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've adopted many of those things. I take a personal interest in my people's mm-hmm. lives, and it shines through. Mm-hmm. It shines through.
I mean, I told this story the other night too. But like when I interviewed for the job in your lab, when I got on the elevator to leave, they said, "You interviewing for the Colgan lab?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Yeah." And they said, "Lucky." So, I mean, when I was a technician, like I felt like I was in a special place, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't, you know, it was you at the top, but like then everybody else, there was this sort of attitude that filtered down mm-hmm. and there was never anything malicious, mm-hmm. like, which is, you know, I've had good lab experiences overall, but like it's not the most common that everybody feels like they're on the same team.
Yeah. No, you came to the lab and you contributed to that environment, but it was a really magical time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, things were just clicking. We had that spectrum of expertise in the lab mm-hmm. there was almost a question we couldn't answer, right?
Yeah.
And it was a magical time.
Yep.
And we didn't have a lot of conflict, right? I you've heard me tell this, that in my office, there's three chairs, right? And when we had conflict, I would bring those two individuals into my office and I would say, we're going to sit here until we solve this problem.
Right. Yeah.
And sometimes people didn't leave happy, but they left and the conflict, the outward conflict was over.
Right. Because it was out in the open.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So the second legacy question, mm-hmm. like I think we can talk about your legacy in a lot of different ways, but I want to do it. And it just sort of occurred to Dan and I the other day, we were talking about this. A lot of people that listen to this podcast are physician scientists, a lot of MD PhDs. And we were thinking about the people that have come out of your lab to go pursue MD PhD mm-hmm. or who are physician scientists mm-hmm. that or MDs, mm-hmm. It's a lot. It's mm-hmm. like a huge number of people, mm-hmm. even just people since I, mm-hmm. like I can say Caleb, Ruth, right? Dan's in your lab, Blair, Mark, Kale now is here with a, mm-hmm. who's a MD with lots of research experience, who's doing the physician scientist thing.
Yeah.
And you know, you're a PhD trained, right? How did you build that? Or like, mm-hmm. was that something you intentionally did? And like, where did it come from? There's a lot of obviously successful PhDs also mm-hmm. came out, but there it struck Dan and I mm-hmm. that it's pretty unusual how many mm-hmm. of us, like,
yeah.
have come out of your lab and who are now like coming back to Colorado. Yeah.
You know, I always had an interest in medicine, and actually my real goal starting off was to be a veterinarian. Hmm. That's why I went to Colorado State University, because they had a really good vet school. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I found science, and I fell in love with science. Mm-hmm. So for me, I always had an interest in medicine, and I liked to hang out with people that were in medicine. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it was the bilinguality. So I'm bilingual. Mm-hmm. I can talk medicine with mm-hmm. my medicine colleagues and ask stupid and naive questions, and they educate me. And then I can talk basic science, mm-hmm. right? So that's why I ended up in the Department of Medicine mm-hmm. and not in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology, right? Because I like the idea of having in the lab both PhDs and MDs, right? So the PhD, they know a lot about one topic, mm-hmm. right? We are cornered, we are experts in specific areas. Mm-hmm. So deeper rather than broader. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of MDs are broader rather than deeper.
Absolutely.
And if you put those two together, you're broad and deep.
Right.
And I think for me, the ability to sit down and talk in a bilingual way mm-hmm. Is really an important part of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want to touch patients' lives mm-hmm. And do that through basic science, mm-hmm. It's what it takes.
Yeah.
And that legacy, I think, shines through. It comes through in my lab. And you know, there are a lot of PhD labs around that are very welcoming of this.
Absolutely.
Particularly on medical campuses. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Related to that, it is, I think, important to have, whether they're physician scientists or physicians who are hanging out, right, informally talking about stuff with the PhD colleagues, like basic scientist colleagues. I think that's an important part of academic medical scientific infrastructure. But there's a real push that is pulling MDs, let's say, to the clinic and maybe pushing PhDs out of academic institutions.
Yep.
And I just want to hear your thoughts on the dangers of that, because mm-hmm. I think if we look historically at what have been the major breakthroughs in patient care, they've come out of academic institutions where there is a good collegial relationship between basic science and clinical medicine, and that it is not an that they do not pull in opposite directions.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's we struggle with this, and each and every time I go as a visiting professor, go to another university, I always ask them how they do this. And my goal on a regular basis is to try to put MDs and PhDs in the same room, trying to speak the same language. Mm-hmm. That's where it's at. I think that's where the magic happens. Mm-hmm. If we can talk to one another and use the same language, that's when magic happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, examples are interesting cases that MDs get. I always ask my MD colleagues, what do you struggle with in the clinic? Mm-hmm. What are the things that you're struggling with right now? You know, whether it's doing an endoscopy or seeing something on a slide or seeing something in a blood chemistry that you don't understand.
Right.
And let's talk about that.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that from a pathophysiology perspective. And how could we as a PhD help you solve that issue? Because that's, I think, where the practicing physician can actually do something that's very fulfilling and very worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And this is something that can even launch them into a new way of thinking about, number one, pathology and physiology, but also how you might treat that patient.
Right? Yeah.
And this is the magic that happens on an academic medical campus.
Yeah.
Right. The worry, and I think as you articulate very nicely, the worry is that do we have the time to do that now?
Right.
You know, as medicine transitions to an RVU-based system, I think our physicians have less and less time to do that. So as I get more and more gray hair and a little bit more influence within the system, I can actually talk to some of the leaders within the the clinical departments and say, you know, is it okay that we carve out some time where we can actually brainstorm a little bit about some of the things that are happening? Because, you know, we stay in our leaders. I'm actually very hopeful. Our leaders, and particularly the young leaders that are coming up through the system, they stay in academics for a reason, right? They don't go to private practice for a reason, and it's because they're curious, right? And, you know, our leadership within the clinics, they have a lot of pressure on them as well. But if you go to them and say, do you think we could carve out a Thursday afternoon at 4 where we could sit down and brainstorm about some ideas? Or can we change grand rounds to include the incorporation of some basic pathophysiology that our faculty can attend as well? Those sometimes turn out to be really, really productive and magical moments. Because then you get to work with your colleagues at a level that you don't normally get to. So I think it's, I think the answer to your question is potentially some of us more senior people, we need to keep some pressure on the leadership and remind them that there are three pillars, right? There's there's medicine. I mean, there's clinical work, there's education, but then there's research. And that we have to stay curious and we have to push to provide some, no matter how small it is, some opportunities to sit down and brainstorm about ideas.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I my big worry is that, like other areas in medicine, RVU becomes the driver, and it's short-sighted because we're you know, yes, our system is makes a lot of money, but we're not going to be able to treat people's, you know, cure people's cancer or Alzheimer's or whatever in 30 years if we're not thinking about it now.
Well, I think if you think about it from this perspective, that every medication that you give to a patient started off with basic science. There's unquestionably that's the case. And the second thing is, don't forget the academic mission, right? Is we are doing what we're doing and making the sacrifices that we are for the academic mission. Those are two really, really imperative things to understand. Every major advancement in patient care started with basic science. There's no question about it. And you can pinpoint that in the literature, right?
Literally any of the big advances that we've seen. And some of them start, like, think about HIV treatment. People were studying retroviruses for years with no, out of intellectual curiosity. And then HIV shows up, and then it's like, all right, well, we understand some of the structure of how this works because we were curious first. So,
Or what are the blockbuster drugs today? Monoclonal antibodies, right? They started off, I guarantee you, with cultured cells.
mRNA vaccines. I mean, this stuff has been cooking for years and years. We take for, you know, there's, I think we think we like in the general public that, you know, COVID came, we made this technology and now we have these vaccines, but it is, you know, years and years and years of work that has gone into it without really a whole lot of hope that this was going to be
biggest experiment ever performed.
Exactly.
Oh yes.
So wrapped up in your answer, I think, is something that I learned from you and I saw when I was working for you, which is a sense of optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think I have seen this in the scientists that I've always tried to emulate, and actually the ones who have done the best in their careers tend to be optimistic. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, Bijan. Is there any other way to be? If you can't be optimistic about your life, it's time to re-examine your life.
Yeah.
I've lived my life, and I think you probably used to hear me say this, is the day that I don't want to go to work, the day that I'm not excited about going to work, is the day I need to find another job. Mm-hmm. And I stress this with my trainees too, mm-hmm. is that if you're really not happy here, let's sit down and talk about a way to find happiness or a way to find another career for mm-hmm. yourself, because you should love to get out of bed in the morning and go to work.
Yeah.
And the day that that's not my case, the day that doesn't happen for me is the day that I'm going to make a change. So, and I just think there's no other way to be, but to be optimistic, you know? And you're going to hear a lot of people in our society talking about this younger generation. I am really hopeful for this younger generation. I think they have a sense of, I grew up in a generation and the generations before me, it was put your nose to the grindstone. Mm-hmm. Our younger generation doesn't do that. They do it together. Hmm. So they work together much, much better than my generation did. And I think there's strength in numbers. Hmm. I'm consistently pleased with how people work together in this younger generation.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I saw this in my high school kids. I have two boys, and in high school, they did a lot of group projects. Mm-hmm. And that's what life is about. It's about collaboration, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you think that's going to change? It's got to, but do you think that's going to change how we do science?
No doubt.
It's starting.
It's already happening.
Yeah. I felt this in my PhD. I realized, like, I had two big papers out of my PhD. Both of them were co-first because I could not to build a project that was going to be acceptable to a bigger, higher impact journal. Yeah. You can't have all those skills on your own. And I don't feel upset by being co-first. Yeah. If anything, I'm proud of that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what I see too. And I think probably in our hard-driven technology fields of today, there's no better example than having your bioinformaticist on the paper, right? Yeah. Is that you can't do it all.
Right.
You just can't do it all. And I think the technologies have changed in a way that you don't have a choice but to be collaborative.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I think this younger generation are much better collaborators than we were.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
As an aside, I will never forget this. One day I came into lab to do some experiment that I don't think I was technically supposed to do, but I had this idea. And so I came in, I snuck in, I think I came up the stairwell for some reason, and you were coming down the stairwell for some reason. Mm. I don't know why, we were on the 10th floor, but I remember it was Saturday, maybe like 11 a.m. and you had your baseball hat on, and I don't know what you were in for or something. And I said, why are you here? And you're like, we're doing something that was exciting. And I was there because I just like wanted to try this experiment when no one else was around. And I remember you said, boy, if this isn't the greatest job in the world.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of hard days, I think, in lab and in medicine too. Yeah. And I still sometimes will take that second to think about, like, how cool is it that we are doing in lab, we're doing something that no one has ever done before and seeing stuff that no one has ever seen before. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
And in the clinic, I mean, you're taking care of patients, like none of us feel like we deserve that sort of privilege, but I think that you stopping and saying, like, just think about this for a second.
Yeah.
How do you, because I think that you touched on this and we talk about it a lot in medicine. There is this epidemic of burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's happening in science, particularly academic science. And it's absolutely happening to physicians and healthcare workers writ large. You don't seem like the kind of person that's had trouble with burnout.
Mm.
What advice do you have for the rest of, you know, whether it's healthcare? I think it comes down to the same sort of underlying principle.
Yes.
And so how have you coped with presumably plenty of setbacks in your career without having this sense of...
Yeah. You know, it seems to me, and I certainly have seen this with a lot of my colleagues over the years, probably no more so than the last 5 years with the pandemic. But, you know, I really, truly believe that those that get burned out are cornered.
Hmm.
They're cornered with their life in ways that they have no control. And they have not a lot of options.
Hmm.
So, it's nothing negative. But, you know, I think in my life, what I've really, really enjoyed, and I think what has allowed me to avoid burnout, is each and every day I do something different, right? And I think you've heard me say this. Some days you're an orator. Some days you're an author. Some days you're a psychiatrist or a priest.
Right.
Some days you're an experimentalist, right? Each and every day I'm doing something different. And that is, I think, the magical formula for not burning out. And truthfully, I think if you make a conscious effort to add variety to your life, that's how you become, I think, number one, an optimist.
Yeah.
And number two, someone who really enjoys what they do.
Yeah.
Burnout is really not an issue there.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, you make a conscious effort to change your behavior, right? You make a conscious effort. So, for example, taking a personal interest in people's lives that you're training, your trainees, that is a tremendous resource for variety in your life, right? Really, truly understanding what people are going through. And then the challenge of helping them make that change, helping them make a transition, identify a problem, find a solution, and most importantly, implement that solution.
Mm-hmm.
And if I think that is, to me, on a weekly basis, something I do, and it is such a joy in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it comes back to you tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how I've avoided burnout.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel cornered. I don't feel like I don't have control of my life. I don't feel like I'm on that treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
And variety is how is mm-hmm. variety is the key to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in a microcosm, I remember someone telling me in grad school, it was a grad student that was having a really hard time. She said, I do one experiment at a time. Like for a month, I'll do one thing and I'll do that Western blot and I will just do that. And it did not resonate with me because I like to do like 15 experiments at a time because 14 of them don't work. But then you have that one result that's like keeps you going.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of what you're getting at in a bigger way.
Right.
Is diversifying your professional and personal life so that you, when something doesn't work out, it's not the defining thing.
Well, that's how I, you know, one of the things that I try to do with all of my students and postdocs is I put them on three projects, right? One that is usually a collaboration with someone in the lab that's on its way to success.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, something that we feel like is moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And then number three is find yourself a real risky project. Mm-hmm. High failure, but great if it works.
Yep. Right?
And find that risky project and work those three together. So when you first come into my lab, you're going to drink through a fire hose.
Yeah. Right?
And you're going to feel a little lost. Mm-hmm. But what you do, what it does is, number one, it brings you up to speed very fast. Mm-hmm. Number two, it's usually very productive, mm-hmm. paper-wise, mm-hmm. manuscript-wise. But number three, you have the potential of really making a major advance, mm-hmm. that, and something that you can really own.
Yeah.
Right. And yes, so then you, I think you also don't feel like you're on that treadmill,
yeah.
just doing that Western blot or
right.
qPCR time and time and time again.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you could, you have to know when to cut fish and cut bait, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is really hard.
Yeah.
Because you get emotionally attached to
it. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
The other, one other question, which is that I think, you know, we've talked kind of a lot about burnout, about how do you keep your mentality, your writing your mission statement to make sure that you are maximizing your strengths, minimizing your weaknesses. But there is a, I think, efflux of, and I will say just specifically PhD trained people from academics. And we had talked about this probably 10 years ago. And I remember you saying, like, there's always a bottleneck in funding. People that get through the bottleneck, it gets better for a while, then there's another bottleneck, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It feels a little bit different because in my PhD class, 9 of the 11 of us went to industry, right? Mm-hmm. And so why do you think that is? And there's nothing, I have nothing against industry, and I think it's an important part of our infrastructure. But I obviously love academics, and I mostly talk to academics. And so what message do you have for people, mm-hmm. either the people that are training us, or us as trainees, that, mm-hmm. you know, is there a place for us in academics? Mm-hmm. What's the future of academics?
Yeah, I know. I certainly have seen this too, where we are getting a migration away from academics and more toward industry or biotech. So, you know, one of the pieces, I don't have the answer, I can tell you. And I think a lot of times it's a very personal decision. But I would say, you know, if someone were to say to me, why did you stay in academics? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's different today. The thing I love about academics is the embracing of a lifestyle. Mm. It is a very, very unique lifestyle. Mm. We get to do something that no one else has done, mm-hmm. number one. Number two, we get to hang out with a lot of really interesting, quirky people, mm-hmm. right? I think number three, the greatest sense of success is watching a young scientist come up through the system and succeed on their own. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of struggles in there. There's mm-hmm. no question. It's not a simple life. It's mm-hmm. not an easy life. You make certain financial commitments. You make certain financial,
sacrifices.
The big sacrifices. There's some sense of that, mm-hmm. but I would say the other thing for me was, I wanted a successful family. Mm-hmm. I wanted a successful marriage, and I wanted to raise good kids. Mm-hmm. And I think academics allows you to do that. Hmm. It gives you the flexibility to do the things that are necessary for that.
Yeah.
I never missed anything my kids did. Mm-hmm. And I have a very successful marriage. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lifestyle you're going to find in very few jobs.
Yeah.
It's very fulfilling. And I think it takes some sacrifices, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like anything worth doing, probably.
Like anything worth doing.
All right. And then just to close, I will never forget, you told me you have certain things that you live by, certain phrases that you go back to. Jim Madera had his, and I asked him for those. We hit one of them already. You need three people that you can call at midnight. Do you have others?
Yes. So, you know, I think one of the other statutes I live by in my life is, and I learned this kind of growing up in the Harvard system, is pick your fights carefully and win your fights. I'm not a big believer in being crying wolf, right? Mm-hmm. And you hear a squeaky wheel gets the grease. That's not something I live by. Mm-hmm. I believe in picking your fights and winning your fights. Mm-hmm. And so I don't pick very many fights, but when I do, I'm going to win. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really great philosophy to live by. Mm-hmm. Because you're not fighting all the time. A lot of times that comes down to protecting the people that are in your group, mm-hmm. right? And you pick those fights carefully, but you win those fights. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important part of my life. And I live by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Okay, Bijan, thanks for what you're doing here. I still listen to all your podcasts because every one of them I learn something. And you know, it is an archive that's a really, really important part of our society.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
I can't believe all you guys want to talk to me.
Oh,
you answer my emails.
You're easy.
Pretty nice. But yeah. And thanks for hiring me.
No, and thank you for
2012.
Thank you for all the contributions you've made. And yeah. I so look forward to watching you grow up and change the world.
I don't know. Yeah. I'll try.
All right.
I got lots of good examples.
Yes, you do. And you've got those three good friends, right?
I got those three good friends. All right, friends, that is our episode for this week. Thank you so much, Dr. Colgan, for everything, but also for sitting down and having this conversation with me. I hope that our listeners enjoy it as much as I did. I also want to thank FASEB for their hospitality and their willingness to produce and support this series. Please go to www.faseb.org and check out their upcoming meetings. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, subscribe, and share us with others you think would appreciate this content. If you have time, leave us a review. And for more from the team here at Behind the Microscope, head to our website at www.behindthemicroscope.com. Behind the Microscope is a production of Sadie Studios and is executive produced by Joe Benke, Carrie Jansen, Michael Sayegh, and me. Our faculty advisors are Dr. Brian Robinson, Dr. Mary Horton, Dr. David Schwartz, Dr. Talia Schwartz, and Dr. Chris Williams. I'm Bijan Sadie. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.